to get through the Iron II period. I'm not too hopeful, really, about being able to cover all of the material that we have to deal with. When you talk about biblical history, the Iron II period is the period in which most biblical history takes place. Certainly, as we've already noted, the period of the United Monarchy under David and Solomon is a very short period of time, no more than 1,000 BC to 922, so less than 80 years. At the death of Solomon, the kingdom breaks up, and from that time on, you have the so-called divided monarchy or the divided kingdom right up until the fall of Jerusalem in 587. And that encompasses all of the so-called Iron II period. Next, you have different terminology applied to what follows, either Iron III or the exilic period. Certainly, we won't get that far today. Up until this point, we've emphasized a number of times how most biblical scholars would take very little stock in the historical accuracy of the early biblical traditions, that is, the stories that are contained within the book of Genesis, much of Exodus, and so forth. By the time you get up to the Iron Age and the events that are recorded in the Bible regarding what was going on from the time of Solomon onward, at that point, the scholarly opinion changes, and the general consensus is that you can count on the Bible at that point as being generally reliable. Not to say that biblical history or the parts of the Bible which deal with historical occurrence certainly are quite different from the way a modern Western historian would write history. But there are at least some similarities. You know, a modern historian has concern with dates, kings, the rise and fall of empires. You see that type of thing being dealt with in the books of Samuel and Kings and so forth. Whereas the earlier stories with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so forth, there's no attempt to document or to date the characters to identify who the kings were being referred to, who the pharaohs are, and so forth. So certainly, by the time you get to the books of Kings and Chronicles and Samuel to a certain extent, you're dealing more with literature which is closer to our modern definition of what a modern history would be. There are so many things to deal with. The history of the divided kingdom, that is, the history of ancient Israel after Solomon's death, is so complicated that I thought one of the ways of dealing with it would be to just list some key dates, and I should emphasize the fact that this is very condensed. A lot of important characters and a lot of important events are left out, but I think if it gets too long, then you lose your place. Hopefully that will at least help orient us, and we'll spend the night going through much of that. Then on the second handout, I have a few little diagrams that we'll also go over in just a minute to illustrate especially what was happening on this side of the Jordan River during this Iron II period, how the borders between the Ammonites and Moabites, the Edomites and Ammonites were fluctuating, and so forth. One thing that I would like to throw in, just a little footnote to our session last time, mentioned that at the death of Solomon, the kingdom breaks up very rapidly. Remember that you have a rather strange thing happening. Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, took over his kingdom. You would expect at that point that there was a good, stable monarchy, that everybody would agree, well, Rehoboam should be the king and proclaim him king. Instead, you find the southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, agreeing that Rehoboam should be a king, whereas the northern tribes not only refuse to acknowledge Rehoboam as a king immediately, but say, we'll talk with you if you come up to Shechem, which was, of course, the center of power in the north. So in a sense, when Rehoboam took the trip up north, he was displaying a sign of weakness, the fact that the northern tribes weren't automatically going to pronounce him king, so he was, in a sense, humiliating himself. Then he got the ultimatum from these 10 northern tribes that your father was very hard on us, he taxed us, Solomon had all these building projects. He was not only taxing everybody, but he was putting Hebrews to forced labor, but only northern people from the northern tribes were put to forced labor. That, of course, increased the alienation and the tension between the north and the south. So the ultimatum to Rehoboam was, you have to lighten the taxes, do away with the practice of forced labor, and then we'll go along with your kingship. To which he responded that my little finger is thicker than my father's thigh, and he will press you with whips, I'll press you with scorpions. They didn't buy it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, he meant, you know, I'll hold you under my finger, and my finger is thicker than my father's thigh. In other words, I'm going to oppress you a lot more harshly than my father had. When he sends out then one of his chief servants in order to quell the riot, they kill him, and Rehoboam makes a rather unroyal departure from Shechem, headed back to Jerusalem in order to save his own skin. All of that's just to point out that the tribes were never that much of a homogeneous group. It seems that the only thing that held the Hebrew tribes together other than David and Solomon was the external threat, primarily from the Philistines, although the Canaanites at the time and the Ammonites and all that were also called the Philistines, which means threat. By the end of David's rule, the Philistines had basically been taken care of, and so there was really no reason for the north to remain loyal to the Davidic in the south. There's an interesting little passage in the book of Genesis, chapter 14, that you might want to look at sometime in your spare time. It's about the last 10 verses. And it may relate to this problem, the tension between the north and the south, and the inability of the south to get strong support from the outlying regions. You have a strange little story in there about Abraham, after Abraham has gone after these Mesopotamian kings who had come down and attacked the cities of the plain. He defeated them up around Damascus, comes back through Palestine, and right around Jerusalem, a fellow by the name of Melchizedek comes out to greet Abraham. It's said that Melchizedek is the priest of Salem, the priest and the king, which was a common combination in ancient times, of Salem, which is almost certainly ancient Jerusalem. And what does Abraham do but offers a tithe, 10% of all the booty that he had just received from these defeated Mesopotamian kings? That's in both Jewish and Christian tradition, often been cited as a passage which explains the origin of tithing, that is, everybody giving 10% of their income to the church or the synagogue and so forth. Genesis 14, I'm not sure the exact verse, but it's about the last 10 verses in the chapter. What's strange about that passage, when you think about it, here Abraham is the patriarch of all the Hebrews, and he's met by an obviously Canaanite priest. He's not a Yahwistic priest. It's said that he worships El Elyon, which was the El God that was worshipped in Jerusalem. Abraham recognizes Melchizedek's authority, or that he should respect him, and therefore gives him his tithe. Some people have said that is a very ancient passage, but just indicates that in the early period, the Hebrews and the Canaanites were very close together and had good relations. You might be a Yahweh worshiper, but you could also pay your respects to a priest of El. What's more likely, if in fact that passage was written down during the time of the monarchy, which we think most of the Old Testament or most of the early sections of the Old Testament probably were, that may in fact be a little tract or a little story that David was distributing in order, or Solomon, in order to get backing for the monarch. When he had this problem with the north refusing to pay tribute or refusing to give their loyalty, they could always turn back to the old tradition and say, remember our father Abraham, that he was coming back through, he gave tribute to this old Canaanite priest king and paid his respects at Jerusalem. Certainly, if Abraham did it for a Canaanite ruler, shouldn't you, as a loyal Israelite, pay tribute and support your Hebrew tradition. That's, at least it seems to me, a very plausible explanation for that otherwise very difficult to understand passage. Okay, before we start through our list here, let's turn to this one handout that has the four maps on the front. Should emphasize this is an oversimplification, but relying upon the biblical text and the few extra biblical texts we have, this appears to be what the situation was in Palestine from the time shortly before the Exodus and traced right up to the time of the Exile. You can see in the first drawing, you have Bashan, the kingdom of Bashan, with Og as its king up north in the vicinity of Syria, coming down from Ramtha. The Zerka River, it seems that in the earliest period, the Ammonites were confined to the area on the east side of the Zerka River, probably out around Zerka and into the desert. They don't appear to have come this far west in this early period. This is before the Hebrews arrived. The Amorites appear to have controlled the area north of Heshbon, or modern Hispam. The Moabites, although you have a tendency to think of Moab being confined between the Arnon and the Wadi Hessa, the Mujib and the Hessa, during the early period, they do seem to have controlled all the territory from modern Hispam, Madaba, the band south. So they controlled a lot of territory into or north of the Wadi Mujib, and then even to the further south. A lot of different people, Canaanites, Girgashites, Jebusites, in the land of Canaan itself. From the biblical account, again, you get the impression, very distinct impression, that just before the Hebrews arrived, now we're in the second drawing here, the Amorites under Sihon had pushed the Moabites down to the south of the Wadi Mujib and controlled all of the territory, say from here to Imam to the Wadi Mujib. The Ammonites were in about the same position, still on the eastern part of the Zerka, although they had moved in at least as far as Imam. Then Moab between the two wadis and moved to the south. The third drawing, this is where it becomes a little more confusing. It's hard to tell exactly what was going on with the boundaries on this side of the river during the so-called period of the judges from 1200 to BC to 1000 BC. It's interesting. There's speculation. The biblical text is fairly clear that the Edomites and the Moabites did not allow the arriving Hebrews to pass through their territory. On the other hand, it appears that once the Hebrews got right around to the Dead Sea, right around to the northern tip of the Dead Sea, that there may have been some kind of a coalition between the Israelites and the Moabites. At least that's one theory. The reason being, Moab having recently been pushed out of their territory north of the Mujib, may have conspired with the Israelites to fight against the Amorites. It would seem unlikely, if the Moabites had opposed the Israelites' entry, that they would allow the Israelites to go ahead and fight against the Amorites without assurances that the Israelites would not then also attack the Moabites. It seems at least possible that the Moabites and the Israelites fought against Sihon together. Then, once the Moabite-Israelite coalition was successful against Sihon, and it became clear that the Israelites were not simply going to go across the river and settle down in Cisjordan, but also wanted to leave some of their people in the fertile land around Madaba and the plains there, that's the point at which you get the story of Balaam being called in. This Mesopotamian diviner who was brought in by Balak, the king of Moab, in order to curse the Israelites. happened, we know that near the beginning of that time of the Judges, you have three so-called tribes, or at least Hebrew groups, that are settling in Transjordan. Reuben, from the Arnon up to around Madaba, then the tribe of Gad, and then a little bit further north, north of the Zerka, the tribe of Manasseh, with the other Hebrew tribes primarily located in the central hill country of Canaan. What's complicated about this, you can see this little arrow coming from Moab across the Mojib, pointed at Reuben. We have several accounts in the book of Judges. The first one is in Judges 3, which says that the Moabites rebelled, invaded the land of Reuben, and even got as far as Jericho, and captured Jericho. You have then a Israelite judge, or Hebrew judge, by the name of Ehud, who leads the forces of Benjamin, which are in that territory around Jericho, forces the Moabites back across the river. It doesn't appear as if they actually followed them all the way into the hill country. At least had one, there was that one confrontation between the Moabites and the Hebrews when the Moabites tried to force themselves back up over the Mojib. We also have another account on which the Hebrew judge Jephthah is also engaged in battles against the Moabites, and again they tried to come over the Mojib. Not only the Moabites, but also the Ammonites at that point were trying to expand their power. And then finally Saul, we also have stories, just a few verses which mention the fact that Saul also engaged in battles against the Ammonites and the Moabites. So it would appear that in the period of the Judges, while the Hebrew tribes were growing together and consolidating their power and expanding their territory, you had the same thing happening on this side with the Moabites, the Edomites, and the Ammonites. And of course, the Ammonites and the Moabites were the chief protagonists of the early Hebrews, simply because they were in such close proximity. Okay, diagram 4 gives a general idea of what Palestine was like during the United Monarchy under David and Solomon. There's little question that at this point, under David, that David attacked Ammon and subjugated it, made it a vassal. The same with Moab securing the area that Reuben had, and making sure that Moab was confined between the Mojib River and the Hassa. It appears that throughout the Davidic and the Solomonic Empire, Moab was, and Ammon as well, was allowed to stay intact. That is, their kingdom wasn't dispersed, but they did have to pay tribute, the same with Edom. Okay, little diagram 5. Well, this gets terribly complicated, as you'll see in a minute. But here you see, after the death of Solomon, approximately where the northern kingdom split apart. And from that point on, whenever you say Israel, you're not talking about all of the Hebrews, but just the northern tribes of the Hebrews. You will also find in the biblical text, it can be rather confusing, the word Ephraim, which is one of the tribes, one of the main tribes in the center of the country there, but especially the Old Testament prophets. When they say Ephraim, they mean the northern tribe or the northern kingdom. And the southern kingdom is the kingdom of Judah. You'll notice Philistia over on the coast. Throughout the Davidic and Solomonic Empire, although again the Philistines were paying tribute to the Hebrew monarchy, they were not completely eradicated or destroyed, they stayed intact. And in fact, lasted longer than the kingdom of Israel
did. So they did become subservient?
Right.
Was it a partnership?
A partnership?
A treaty type thing. They were subservient to the
right, kingdom. Right. Yeah, after David. That's
after
when
David.
You get total domination. It's actually during the divided monarchy, which is a period of weakness for the ancient Hebrew kingdom, that you find the kingdoms here in Transjordan flourishing. and that's understandable, since they're in direct competition with each other. Whenever the Hebrew kingdom was strong, it was difficult for the kingdoms over here, since they were paying tributes to the other side. Whenever the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah was experiencing in a period of depression, the kingdoms over here were flourishing and expanding their territory. And during this time, as you'll see, Moab again goes across the Mojib into what, according to the Hebrew, would be considered the territory of Reuben. Although we know at this time, or at least by 900 BC, the tribe of Reuben seems to completely die out. Maybe they got tired of being trampled on by people running back and forth and just left. You don't know what happened to them, but you don't hear of the tribe of Reuben being in the territory of Manasseh. Not a part of what? Yeah, well, again, they would be considered part of the northern kingdom, as far as, right, when you try, at least the northern kingdom defined as the other 10 tribes, the southern kingdom being just Judah and Benjamin. But of course, they don't really fall within the territory, the logical territory of the northern and southern kingdom, and that may well be why Reuben and Gad as well just kind of disappeared from the scene. They were in an undefensible position as soon as, well, after Solomon, the Ammonites and the Moabites reasserted their independence, Omri, the northern king, was able to reestablish hegemony over Ammon and Moab, but then shortly after that, Moab rebelled again and got the territory back. And certainly, I don't know, if I was a Hebrew living at that time, I certainly wouldn't want to be over here in what definitely was in either Ammonite or Moabite territory. And both the northern and southern kingdom of the Hebrews were just unable to maintain control for any length of time during those very rocky years. Yeah, certainly, not only does Moab expand, but Ammon expanded during this time period, which also coincides then with the rise of Assyrian power in Mesopotamia. In 587, Jerusalem falls. The southerners, the primary citizens anyway, are taken into exile. Some interesting things happen. The kingdoms of Ammon and Moab escaped that initial Babylonian thrust in 587. They had also collaborated in a rebellion against Babylon, so they were really lucky to get away with it. But Nebuchadnezzar came in, smashed into Jerusalem, and was satisfied then to just extract tribute from Ammon and Moab, went home. They rebelled again and came back down in 582. Completely dominated Ammon and Moab. But this is what the picture you get. Immediately after the exile, after 582, the principal citizens of both Ammon and Moab have been taken into exile, as have the principal citizens of Judah. But the two kingdoms continue to exist for a little while. Moab fades away slowly shortly after this time. Also, right after the exile, the Edomites, who had always been in the south, migrated over into the Negev and into the area of Hebron, and found the Idumean kingdom, as it appears in the New Testament. People like Herod the Great is probably one of the most famous biblical characters. He is of Idumean, which means ultimately Edomite extraction. The Nabataeans appear on the scene around this time to assert their domination. Well, didn't mean to spend that much time, but you might want to look that over. It's difficult as you're reading the biblical text to see exactly what changes are taking place in terms of boundaries. It's all very confusing. Okay, let's turn to this other handout now, and I think we'll just go down through it and see how far we can get. Okay, 922, the death of Solomon, Rehoboam, his son, becomes the king of the southern kingdom, Judah. Rehoboam, Jeroboam the first, becomes the king of Israel. Should make one comment about Jeroboam. Jeroboam had been an important official under Solomon, but he had participated in a coup against Solomon, which was unsuccessful, and he fled to Egypt and was taken care of or looked after in Egypt. Upon hearing of the death of Solomon, Jeroboam ran back up to the northern kingdom as soon as it was clear that the northern kingdom was not going to go along being dominated by Jerusalem in the south. Jeroboam was pronounced the first king of the north, which in that kind of thing becomes the king of Israel. It would appear that when Jeroboam was down in Egypt, that the Egyptians had a reason for keeping him there, probably because they wanted to reestablish their control of Palestine. Certainly from the biblical point of view, when you read the biblical text, biblical authors felt that the reason that the Israelites were successful in their conquest, establishing a monarchy and so forth, was that God had given them the land, God had blessed them. It's a purely theological explanation of history. If you look at it from a totally secular point of view, you can also say that maybe Yahweh was behind a lot of this, but there was also another very important political fact, and that is that from the 13th century on, there really was a power vacuum. The Egyptians, who had controlled Palestine up to that point, were weak. The Hittites had been overthrown by the Sea Peoples. The Assyrians were on the rise in Mesopotamia, but they weren't really a dominant force, and their influence wasn't being felt down in Palestine. So it was where, throughout most of history, you had big dominant powers crashing through Palestine. During that time, from about 1200 BC until around, well, at least about 900 BC, about that 400-year period, there is no major power dominating Syria and Palestine. So what you find instead is that you have these small little mini-states, the Hebrews, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, and so forth, fighting it out amongst one another. So the northern and southern kingdom split right after the death of Solomon. 4 years later, in 918, Shishak, the Egyptian of Libyan extraction, invades Palestine. Obviously, or it would appear at least obvious, that by keeping Jeroboam, he was hoping to ferment division within ancient Israel. Certainly one two kingdoms split. There wasn't a clean split. There was fighting between the north and the south. And Shishak seemed to want to take advantage of that, went on a raiding party, attacked cities both in Judah and in Israel in the north, and then came over into Transjordan as well. Unfortunately, things were still not going too well in Egypt, so in spite of Shishak's invasion and his successes, Egyptian power was not established in this part of the world at that time. What was a definite result of that invasion of Shishak was that Ammon, Edom, and Moab, which had been dominated by the United Kingdom of David and Solomon, had the chance now to break away. Certainly neither the Northern Kingdom nor the Southern Kingdom was in a position to assert their authority over Ammon, Edom, and Moab. Although they also suffered from the raid, we have some evidence of that. One site is Nimrin in the Jordan Valley. It seems to have a destruction at an Iron Age level, which, at least in Jim Sauer's opinion, probably leads to that invasion of Shishak. We're quite certain from Shishak's own records also that he did come into Transjordan, but ultimately it worked to the favor of the kingdoms here in Transjordan. Okay, following Shishak's invasion, the south and the north both made comebacks of a sort. You find that in the South, the Davidic monarchy stays intact almost up until the time of the fall of Jerusalem. There's one interruption with a non-Davidic ruler. But basically, the chain of power went very smoothly in the South. The problem was the Southern Kingdom didn't have the agricultural land, didn't have the natural resources that the North did, and so it never achieved the wealth of prosperity that the Northern Kingdom did. Also, the Southern Kingdom was a little bit more isolated. The Northern Kingdom was right along the major trade routes, which was to its advantage in terms of wealth and prosperity. It was also to its disadvantage in terms of the interests that other people had in parts of the Northern Kingdom. And you find throughout the Iron Throne period that the major conflict, the major enemy of the Northern Kingdom is Damascus, or the Arameans, as they're identified. Also, instead of having a dynasty like the Davidic dynasty in the South, the model for the North was more the idea of the old judges, who were charismatic leaders who just took over power because they were charismatically endowed and people recognized their authority. Months before they're killed by the general and replaced. There is one example that in this one week in the Northern Kingdom when three different kings ruled within that same week. One was assassinated, reigned for a couple days, somebody assassinated him and took over. So you have those three rulers in the one week. So it was a very unstable period. The King Omri in 876 took over, and he was the first one really to establish order and to make anything out of the Northern Kingdom. The original capital of the Northern Kingdom under Jeroboam the First had been established at Shechem, but then very quickly moved to Tirzah, which is northeast of Shechem. After 6 years, according to the biblical text, Omri moved his capital from Tirzah to Samaria, which is modern Sebastian. The site that was completely uninhabited, actually they do have some Chalcolithic habitation, but certainly in the Iron Age there was no previous habitation on it. Omri bought the hill with the idea of making it his new capital. Excavations at a site called Telfara, which has been identified with Tirzah, indicates that you do have a break in occupation in the Iron Age and certainly the beginnings of occupation at Samaria, so we're pretty sure from the biblical text that we can date that right around 870 when that occupation of Samaria begins. It's interesting, about the only thing that the biblical text says about Omri was that he reigned for 12 years and that he was a very wicked man. You wouldn't get the impression from the biblical text that he was important at all, but in fact, from the Syrian text, we find that long after Omri, and even long after the dynasty of Omri has faded away, the Assyrians are still referring to people in the Northern Kingdom as the sons of Omri, even though they have no relation to Omri in the later time. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. It gets back to where you're dealing with the difference between relative chronology and absolute chronology. Once you get into the Iron Age, you have some very good pegs because some of the events that are mentioned, and we'll get to that in just a minute here, for example, Jehu, who is one of the later kings that comes just after the Omri. There is a nice little obelisk found in Assyria which talks about him giving tribute to Shalmaneser III. So those dates or those texts are needed. You have an awful lot of cross-dating within the biblical text itself. That is, one king, the king of the north, reigning at the same time as a certain king of the south. The trouble is, it's very difficult often to juggle those dates and see exactly what is going on. There are some problems, but it's dated pretty close. Again, I don't read Akkadian, so I don't, you know, wouldn't be able to criticize how they arrive at the dates in the Akkadian text, or how question of type chronologies or low chronologies and how much you go with. But certainly from this time, you really are entering into the historical period. You have writing as early as the Early Bronze Age, but certainly by the Iron Age, there's enough documents. Again, not only in Mesopotamia, but also in Egypt. Shishak's invasion of Palestine is written on inscriptions in the Temple of Karnak. Thutmose also has inscriptions. They're talking about his excursions into Palestine. Necho's, I believe that, I don't know if it's in Karnak, but I believe that Necho's battle against the Assyrians at Carchemish No, 605 is also documented. So again, with a lot of those things, once you get one date, then you can work, you know, back several hundred years from that. Yeah, again, you know, I just don't know enough about the, they're from the Assyrian and Egyptian inscriptions, which had their kings and had them dated by solar calendar dates. But, yeah, I'd have to say at this point, I'm an expert to say where they actually arrived at. Certainly, the final form of the biblical text that we have that went through those final editions in the South, the so-called Deuteronomic redactor or editor, although that was initially produced in the North, it was finally edited in the South. And one of the things that you find constantly in the evaluation of the kings, you will, if you read carefully, you'll note that there is not one northern king that the Bible has anything good to say about them. They're all, there's a formula that sums up. He walked in the way of his father and in the way of Jeroboam, and he did great wickedness in the sight of Yahweh. Then he goes on to the next thing, he says, he walked in the way of his father and in the way of Jeroboam, and did great evil and so forth. And clearly, one of the criteria in the Bible for judging the northern kingdoms was the fact that they did not recognize the Davidic monarch. And so no matter what they did, no matter how many battles they won, no matter how many religious reforms they had, as long as, by definition, they refused to recognize the legitimacy of the Davidic monarchy and at the same time, of course, recognize the fact that the Temple of Jerusalem was the place of worship, they were, by definition, wicked. Of course, the southern kings don't come off much better, but at least there's Josiah and Hezekiah that get good reviews. But that's another. Okay, we wouldn't know that Omri was a particularly influential person if it wasn't for perhaps the most important inscription that's ever been found in Jordan, and that is the Moabite stone, the Mission Stone, which is found in Diban in 1868. It's a copy of a stele which was written at the request and command of Misha, the king of Moab, around 850. and you can argue maybe 10 years either way, but roughly 850. And he is bragging about the victory that he had over Omri's son. Now it's a question of whether that was in fact Omri's son, who would be Ahab, or one of the later members of the Omri dynasty, since in ancient times he could be the son of Abraham, even if Abraham was a great-great-great-great-grandfather. But in any case, it's clearly stated in the Mishnah Stone that Omri was the one who came in under his under his reign and regained control over Moab. We really don't know about Ammon. It would seem quite likely that Omri also subjugated Ammon, since Ammon is in between the northern kingdom and Moab. Again, we just don't have the written records from Ammon to tell us. And of course, the biblical author, the biblical editor with his southern orientation, is not going to give us a lot of details about the successor of the northern king. But in any case, Omri seems to have dominated the land of Moab for 40 years, according to the Mishnah Stone. Again, there's a question. Does that mean actually 40 years? Does it mean one generation or two generations? Is it a perfect number, like reigning for 40 days and 40 nights, and Jesus being tempted for 40 days in the wilderness? You know, does it just mean a long time? It's a question. But certainly under Omri, the northern king dominated the countries here in Transjordan, and under Misha, probably following the death of Ahab, only some the Moabites were able to fight back. I have here in this listing 843 for the Mishnah Stone. Again, that's, you know, don't take that too serious. It is interesting to read the account in 2 Kings, chapter 3, verse 4 following, which gives the Israelite view of what the Moabite stone is talking about. And it's an interesting study of the validity or historical accuracy of ancient sources. Most scholars would agree that they're talking about the same event. And in 2 Kings, the biblical author claims that the northern and southern kingdom came together, attacked Moab, and had a resounding success. And the only reason they finally pulled back was because the Moabite king sacrificed his son on the wall. Whereas, according to the Moabite stone, he went to battle with Omri and completely annihilated Omri. So that the Israelites, according to Misha, ceased to exist from that point on. And it's obvious that both of them. Okay, Ahab became king, the son of Omri, around 869. I imagine Ahab is probably the most well-known person, even if you haven't studied the Bible, his famous wife, Jezebel, who was the daughter of the king of Phoenicia. At this time, the major problem that Ahab had was with Damascus, or Aram, or the Arameans, and the area they were interested in was what had formerly been the so-called tribe of Manasseh's territory, right up here in the northern part of Jordan, the southern part of Syria. Ahab fought a number of battles against the Syrians, was fairly successful. I might just say, always be careful, during this period, you do need to distinguish between the Syrians and the Assyrians, who are further north of Mesopotamia. He had a number of successes against Damascus over this contested territory in the northern part of Jordan. Then you have an interesting thing happening. In 853, Shalmaneser III, who was a very successful ruler in Assyria, is on the rise and threatened both Syria and the northern kingdom. So for a very short period of time, Ahab and the northern kingdom and Syrians mended fences and went off with combined forces to fight against the Assyrians. At the Battle of Tarpur, and Orontes River around 853. Again, it was, nobody was an outstanding victor of the battle, but at least the Assyrians were turned back. And you'll notice that 3 years later then, in 850, the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead takes place. Ahab is back fighting the Syrians over this contested territory in north of Jordan. So you find that constantly throughout the Iron Age, that whenever a major power poses a threat, you find all of the little small kingdoms in this region banding together, fighting off the big power. As soon as that threat's taken care of, they come back and start fighting among themselves again. I'll go ahead with the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead, which most people would identify with a site called Tel Ramath. If you've gone to Damascus along the main road that goes out of Jerash, you go by the University of Yarmouk property, which will someday supposedly be the university campus. And right at the northern end of the campus, if you look off probably about 2 kilometers to the east, you'll see a little tell there that Paul Lapp excavated in the 1960s, which is an Iron Age site, quite possibly Ramoth-Gilead.
Swelling your nose, you can't miss.
Yeah. So, Ahab, here again, in order to fight the Syrians, the northerners and the southerners who had constantly been fighting inside of men fences went into battle of Ramoth-Gilead against the Syrians. Should say something about prophets. Prophets, although we have a tendency to think of a prophet as being a religious person who's dealing with religious subjects, a thing that you find, especially in the early period of Old Testament times, as well as in extra-biblical texts, is that prophets were primarily advisors to the king. They usually had this actual role of a court prophet whose main purpose would be to advise the king whether he ought to go into this battle or whether he should stay home, kind of like your daily horoscope reading. And of course, they were taken very seriously. We're told that just before this battle, Ahab consults all of the prophets of northern Israel to make sure that everything's going to go okay. Everybody says, of course, it's going to go okay. Yahweh is on your side, except for one fellow who says that if you go into battle, you're never going to come back. Evidently, that was taken seriously enough by Ahab to demand that his friend or his fellow king in the south, Jehoshaphat, whom he didn't like, dress up in his own garb, that is the garb of the northern king, whereas Ahab dressed in the garb of an average warrior. In fact, during the battle, a stray arrow hit Ahab, and by the time he got back to Samaria, he was dead. That happened right around 850 then. And most people, that's why I did put the Moabite stone after the death of Ahab. Most scholars would say it was probably with Ahab's death that the northern kingdom weakened even more, and that made it possible then for the Moabites to rebel. It was possible that that had taken place even earlier. I do want to make one brief comment about Elijah's contest with prophets of Baal. Although the biblical text doesn't have too many good things to say about Ahab, it's even got worse things to say about Jezebel, his wife. She was a Phoenician, a Baal worshiper of Baal, who was the main fertility god. You might get the impression at times that Jezebel was a very godless woman or a very licentious woman. In fact, the problem she had with Elijah was that they were two people who were very much alike. That is, at least they were two religious fanatics. It appears as if Jezebel was determined not only to promote Baalistic worship in northern Israel, but actually to make it the state religion, which it was, of course, in a position to do as the premier section. Whereas Elijah was a strong Yahwist, demanding that the Northerners have nothing to do with Baalistic worship. We're told that she had hundreds of Baalistic prophets with her. The perhaps one of the most familiar scenes in the Old Testament is, if you ever went to Sunday school and you saw these little posters with Elijah on Mount Carmel with this little altar in a contest with the prophets of Baal. According to the story, there was a drought in the area. Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal to a contest. It's easy to overlook the significance of the actual contest that he picks. Whereas Yahweh had been known primarily as a god of war, leading the Israelites into battle against their enemies, Baal was the fertility god. So certainly it was in Baal's power either to dispense or to withhold the rains. And that seems to be really the crux of the whole matter. It was in the middle of a drought. So Elijah sets up a little contest to determine who, in fact, is the god of fertility. If it's Baal, or if Yahweh is in control of the forces of nature as well as war and so on. After they built the altars, of course, the prophets of Baal are unable to bring the rain. It's a really humorous section, I think, 1 Kings chapter 17 and 18. After the prophets of Baal prove unsuccessful, Elijah starts deriding them in actually very vulgar language, asking, where is your God? Is he gone on a vacation? Maybe he's sleeping, you have to yell a little louder. And he says, maybe he's behind a tree taking a leak. As I say, getting pretty vulgar. Finally, it's his turn, the lightning comes down, burns up the altar. And then you get an interesting thing, which probably, there's a lot of questions to what extent legendary features have creeped into stories like this. But certainly it appears that Elijah did, at that point, go and massacre, completely slaughter, at least 400 or 500 of the prophets of Baal, which again was not only a religious statement, but also a very political statement. Obviously, when Jezebel found out about this, she was less than pleased. And from that point on, Elijah was on the run. But running away from Jezebel, but not staying out of religion or especially politics. That when he goes down to Sinai, he has his revelation. Again, it's not really a religious revelation. The revelation is for him to go back out to anoint Jehu as king and to anoint a fellow by the name of Hazael as king in Damascus. In other words, the revelation that Elijah got when he passed on to Elisha was that he was to foment revolution in the northern kingdom and revolution in Syria. And that, in fact, is what he did. He encouraged Jehu, who had been an army general of Ahab, to rebel against Ahab, not Ahab, but the sons of Ahab, who were in power at that time, and also Hazael to rebel against the present king of Syria, which he did. Yeah, I think we'd better close at this point. I would ask you to read between now and next time, if you read 2 Kings chapter 9, and maybe chapter 10 too. That talks about the outcome of the rebellion of Jehu against the house of Omri, and especially if you like bloody, gory stories, that's about the best, where Jezebel gets thrown out of the top of a house, trampled with a horse, and then eaten by dogs. Jehu, in his purge, not simply does he kill the former king of the north, but goes around and has the entire family exterminated, as is followers from the heads of 70 nobles of the house of Omri to him at Jezreel. And that's a very important point. You'll find the prophets in later periods talking about Jezreel. Whenever you say Jezreel, it's a curse, and it's always harkening back to the days when Jehu had all these baskets full of heads brought to him in the insurrection. Okay, we'll pick up here next time.